Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Sarah, welcome back. Last week was our intermittent best of show because you didn't have internet. So welcome back to the 21st century.
Thank you. I have to say it was very, very strange how disconnected I felt without phone or internet for 2 days. And it was, I still had my cell phone. So actually I wasn't that disconnected. I just had a small screen. I wasn't connected on a big screen, and it was the strangest feeling. And it ended up being like a mini vacation. Like I just was like, oh, I can't write blog posts. Oh, darn. I can't work on my book. Although I totally could have. And yet I took 2 days off, and it was really rejuvenating, actually. It's kind of like a strange, like forced holiday. I'll take it. I needed it. It's good. So I'm back, and I'm happy to be back.
Awesome. I think that kind of mindset ties in a lot with what we might be talking about with our guest today. So welcome to the Paleo View, Mark Sisson.
Thank you for having me.
I think you need no introduction, but I do want to just mention and a note of appreciation and thanks for all of us who are coming to the paleo world after you helped pave the ground. We're going to talk a lot about your new book. But in the meantime, the existing material and genius that you've put out to the collective force by your own free, generous heart on the web has changed my life and many people's lives. So I just want to thank you for all that you've done, including what we'll talk about tonight. And not to like make you embarrassed or uncomfortable, but I do hope that as we talk on the show, people who might not be as familiar with your work, which I'm not quite sure how that's possible, will make an effort to go and find it. I know Sarah uses your site a lot for some of her scientific references. So
it's one of the, there's two sites that I send people to when I don't have the answers. And it's basically chriscresser.com and marksdailyapple.com. Like those are the two like great sources of really well scientifically researched and referenced material. And it's been awesome. Like you're, yeah.
Well, thank you for that acknowledgement. I'm gushing on this site. But I appreciate being appreciated.
Don't we all?
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I do it all for appreciation, Stacey. You do it for appreciation or money?
I don't know. I think I'm doing it just because I'm insane. No, I do it because I've seen the amazing health benefits in my children, and I want to try to share that with as many people as possible who could, you know, potentially change their family's lives. So I'm not quite sure what category that falls into, but certainly appreciation makes it much easier to continue. So yeah. Awesome. Well, Mark, do you have any hot news that you want to share with us? I know we're going to get into some Primal Connection conversation. The way that the show format works is usually Sarah and I gossip in the front, and it seems kind of awkward to waste your time with gossiping. And
but you are welcome to gossip.
For sure.
Why would you assume I don't like gossip?
You're right. I should not assume these things.
I'm, you know, and we can talk about, you know, the primal connection and the benefits of gossip to our emergent ancestral.
There you go.
Yeah.
Way to just tie it all together there.
The brain expects us to gossip, so why would we want to deny the brain that pleasure?
Well, now I feel a whole lot less guilty about it. So kind of halfway on topic, Sarah, I heard that you have a lot of pig in your house. Are you figuring out what to do with it?
I do. So I picked up my half pig on Saturday, and so every single piece of meat that I got is something that I'm familiar with. So there's not going to be a whole lot of like magical experimentation. I did get the jowl has been trimmed and sliced and has this like complete delicacy look to it. So I am going to actually try some new recipes for that, and if they work, they'll probably be in the book. I have never seen jowl that looked like something you needed to do something special for. It was really beautiful, and I just looked at it and went, "Oh, jowl is a delicacy." I hadn't thought of jowl that way before, but unfortunately, the meat processor that my farmer brought his pigs to threw out like everything that was in the abdominal thoracic cavity. They threw out the skin. They threw out the head, I guess for lead contamination reasons, not to get too graphic. But they threw out the trotters. They threw out everything. And that was almost for me like, that for me is the better part.
It's like blasphemy.
I know. And it just like, I mean, they threw out the heart and the kidneys and the liver. Like, I mean, I can kind of understand them not wanting to clean intestines, and a lot of places won't do that. And I kind of get that because I don't think I want to do that myself. Although no one's asked me, and I reserve the right to change my mind if someone does ask me. But yeah, I was kind of like, you know, heart and liver and kidneys are kind of normal. Maybe they're not normal. Maybe I am just so far down my paleo journey that normal is not what I think of normal is like really crazy. But I just kind of think those are sort of like normal organs. Like those should be easy ones to keep. So I was a little disappointed by that. But I have some gorgeous, gorgeous shoulder roasts. And we had chops for supper tonight and last night. And I am going to make a whole lot of sausage. I have like 25 pounds of ground pork, which is like a whole, that's a lot of sausage. And it's going to be glorious. I'm looking forward to it. So I am such a nerd that I'm geeking out over half of a pastured pig in my freezer. Just, you know, that's what you wanted, right? That was
it's the little things in life.
The answer that you were looking at. So I'm definitely going to have to save some of my pork for Beyond Bacon recipes. Just throwing that out there.
Well, I was actually trying to use it as a not so subtle transition to give kind of a recommendation for people, because part of the lessons learned in doing Beyond Bacon is figuring out how to properly order whole animals from your purveyor. And in the process of doing that, we've learned that you can ask for certain processing standards, and you can find out usually ahead of time what processor and what their standards are before you send your animal to be slaughtered there. And since you're paying for the processing, you can ask them to go to a different processor. You can ask them to make sure that they put down an animal in a certain way that doesn't give it lead poisoning, in which case you can then get all the parts. So hopefully...
Well, definitely lesson my farmer learned. Has said that he's going to find a different processor for next time. So hopefully, I think this was a new one for him as well. And he was quite disappointed because he likes trotters too. He was also like really upset that the trotters were maybe he just told me that. Maybe it's not true and he's just keeping all the trotters for himself.
No, that's serious gossip. Mark, are you a nose?
I'm sitting here with awful envy.
I was wondering how you felt about the nose to tail experience there.
Yeah. No, it all sounds good. And that's crime. Blasphemy is a word that I think you used to throw out those parts.
Yeah. All right. Well, Let's not dwell on that.
On those lost body parts.
Let's be happy with the pasture pork that we have and move on. I'm really excited for this week's Science with Sarah, which will be Science with Mark and Sarah. So maybe, Sarah, you can jump into the topic that you'd like to discuss.
Yeah, sure. So today's topic for Science with Sarah actually is partially inspired by some of the research that I have been doing for my book, but also inspired by a lot of the ties between what I've been reading about and what Mark is writing about in The Primal Connection. And so I want to specifically talk about the hygiene hypothesis. And the hygiene hypothesis is a way of explaining the increased incidence in autoimmune and immune-related disorders. So this encompasses a huge range of diseases, from the 100-plus autoimmune diseases, but also things like asthma and eczema. And so anything where the immune system is having a disproportional reaction to an antigen. So in immune disorders like asthma, those are not, it's just the immune system is not targeted and it's just overactive. In autoimmune disease, the immune system is targeted and overactive, and it's targeted against proteins and cells within the human body. So what the hygiene hypothesis states is that one of the contributors to this increased rise in these types of diseases is how sterile our environment has become. So the fact that we use hand sanitizer and wash our hands, and that we're using bleach to clean everything, and that we don't play outside in the dirt anymore, and we're not exposed to the same kind of barrage of viruses, bacteria, but both infectious organisms and also probiotic organisms the way we used to. And there's fairly limited scientific evidence to back up this idea, but where it really came from was observational studies done by the World Health Organization that noticed that the incidence of sort of autoimmune and immune diseases like multiple sclerosis or type 1 diabetes in these very rural African and Asian communities where people were living very, poverty-stricken, but almost sort of hunter-gatherer, but also like growing, like hunter-gatherer-grower type communities, that the incidence of these diseases was very low in these communities. But when those same people relocated to modern settings, into cities, that they had a much higher risk all of a sudden of getting these conditions. And there's some other interesting pieces to the puzzle. And certainly there's a lot of information that is looking at the role of the bacteria that normally live, not just in our guts, but on our whole bodies, and the role that they play in terms of modulating our immune system. And there's 35,000 different species of bacteria among all humans that live on and in us. Each person typically has like 500 different kinds. But when you look at all humans as a whole, there's like 35,000 different species of bacteria that can live within our bodies in a beneficial, mutually beneficial relationship. So there's a lot more, like a 99.99% more that is unknown about these bacteria than what we do know. But we do know that having healthy gut bacteria is essential for modulating the immune system, and 80% of our immune system is in our guts. The other really interesting piece to this puzzle is some research into helminth therapy. Stacey, I don't know if you've heard about this. Helminth therapy is where if you have a specific type of, it's being used for some autoimmune diseases, that they will infect you with a specific parasite. And they have found that for some diseases, some sort of parasite pairings can actually end up treating the disease. So the idea is that we co-evolved with these parasites and these bacteria and all these other types of microorganisms to have a mutually beneficial, a symbiotic relationship with them. And their role in our health is to control our immune system. So they help activate our immune system when it needs to be activated, and they help to deactivate our immune system when it's overstimulated. So they modulate the immune system. So, Mark, what I really thought was very, very interesting in your book was you have like an entire chapter about the importance of dirt. And it really ties into this, you know, idea that we're too clean, that we're not getting exposed to probiotic bacteria because we don't play in the dirt anymore. So
exactly.
Well,
I mean, you stated the case pretty convincingly, and it's something that I've been looking at very closely for years and years and years, not just in writing this book, but in the initial book, in the Primal Blueprint, I made a comment that Grok ate dirt not only every day but with every bite he took, because there was no such thing as wiping dirt off the food, and every piece of food that was consumed had some kind of dirt on it, and that was what repopulated our gut with all of these bacteria. And as we're seeing more and more now, the importance of a healthy gut biome. There's several studies that are trying to plot the human gut biome and create a map similar to the genome.
Yeah.
That looks at where and how these 35,000 different microbes are dispersed individually, and kind of trying to figure out what is it among those of us who seem to be very healthy is different in terms of gut biome than those of us who seem to be perennially sick and always kind of miserable and with immune compromises. It's an incredibly fascinating area of health, and it is so ultimately low tech. I mean, the fact that fecal transplants now are becoming more and more common.
I'm glad I didn't have to be the one to bring it up,
as a cure for stuff that historically was addressed with not just massive antibiotics, but ripping out parts of your innards for people with Crohn's and other GI problems. Just crazy, crazy stuff. But back to – so I have a chapter in my book, The Primal Connection, which looks at the nature connection and the fact that our bodies, our brains, our bodies, virtually every cell in our body which has the DNA recipe to build a happy, healthy, strong, productive, lean, fit human being expects these inputs. It expects us to be playing in the dirt. It expects us to be consuming dirt and microbes. It expects us to have these microbes living on our skin, not just in the gut, which is, as you already stated quite succinctly, 80% of our immune system, but also topically the reason that we don't get in fungal infections all the time is because we have bacteria residing on the skin that is always fighting off the fungus among us. And so people who, so the people who are scrubbing away in the shower and taking 20-minute hot showers and using all of their antibacterial lotions and soaps may be doing more harm than good. What I tried to address with this book is understanding the expectations of these hunter-gatherer genes that reside within us, and then finding ways that we can realign, reconnect with our ultimate human nature. And with regard to the nature connection, part of it was simply being outside and smelling the smells that our brains and our olfactory senses expect, hearing the sounds that are the sort of resonant sounds that the wavelengths that our brains for millions of years have come to expect, whether it's the chirping of birds and crickets or the rustling of wind in the leaves or water or rain falling. It's not the cacophonous traffic noises and jets taking off and jackhammers and dot matrix printers and everything else that tend to cause a tremendous amount of discordance within us. So it's the smells and it's the sights and the sounds, but also it's this very visceral exposure to dirt. And it is the most primal way to reacquaint our bodies with these symbiotic bacteria is just simply by playing in the dirt. And it, you go, well, listen, I'm living in New York City on the 42nd floor of an apartment building. How can I possibly play in the dirt? Well, it's as simple in many cases as just getting a garden going on your windowsill and buying some potting soil and playing with that soil with your hands and then not washing it off after.
And then having a little taste.
Just maybe even a little taste.
The white things.
I saw something on the internet the other day about some guy that there's a Japanese restaurant owner who has started cooking dirt. He literally makes dirt soup and dirt sauces to put on his food. So that's cool. Maybe I'm not there yet. But
well, it reminds me of the activities that we do as a family. Like, we do a lot of pick your own farms, especially, you know, we live in Virginia, so it's a seasonal state. We don't, unfortunately, have a lot right now, but in the spring, summer, and fall, you know, we seasonally pick our own vegetables and fruits, and the kids will, you know, beeline to the blueberry bush, which is at their level, and they will literally, you know, hand and fist yep. the blueberries into their mouth, and we always get comments from the other families that are around that say, you shouldn't let them do that. It needs to be washed. And of course, you know, we're going to a pesticide-free farm. So for me, if there's bird poo residue or whatever it is that someone's concerned about, I just feel like their immune systems are strong from the nourishing diets that they're eating. It's their biological desire, and that's what they're drawn to do. So it seems to me natural to let them do it.
It's very natural, and those are good points that you made. The fact that I recommend that we go out and play in the dirt, it's tough to find good dirt these days. And, so much of the what we used to call soil is now just dirt. And it's been, infiltrated with heavy metals from a smog if you live in an urban area or industrial pollution of any whatever kind. So I'm not suggesting that you go out behind a slag heap and start playing, in the dirt there. But just the notion that and to go out to a farm where there, it's clearly been pesticide-free and herbicide-free, perfect what you're doing with your kids. And it's kind of cute to hear the other parents tell you how unhygienic that is. But then to have those kids go to school with colds and flu and stuffy noses that they never seem to get rid of because
exactly.
their immune systems don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same exact philosophy. I don't know. I know your children are no longer in preschool, but there's like this new revolution in preschool where every 5 seconds someone needs to be using hand sanitizer. My husband, who co-ops at the preschool, they give him like an apron and they literally put it in there as like a emergency item so that you can have it with him at all times. And my husband will come home and laugh and he'll be like, I didn't use that hand sanitizer. You know, like we're not, to us, even just inherently before understanding the bacterial concept of it, before we were paleo, before we understood that kind of stuff. It's like,
right.
that's life. That's germs. Like that's what we played in as kids. I remember going out into the creek and playing outside in the back before there was all this fear of what's going to happen outside or whatever it was. That was even just
well,
a
now
generation
it's
ago.
Giardia. Every creek has Giardia. And it's like, oh my goodness, the Giardia is going to jump into me and I'm going to immediately get diarrhea. I mean, it's just ridiculous. So there's a point at which you sort of have to become intuitive about this. And you say, okay, we're going to take the kids out to the farm and we're going to play in the dirt and that's going to be great. Or we're going to, you know, garden in some loam and some soil that we bought with great assurance that it was clean, but it was good, fertile soil. Those are all good. Then there is the fact that you're going to show up at school one day and kids are going to be there who probably ought not to be there that day. And it may be appropriate to wash up, you want to kind of figure out where you fit on that spectrum of accessing all those healthy bacteria, but not, you know, getting too immersed in some, cesspool of colds and flu just because you think you can. You know what I mean?
I actually had that conversation with my oldest daughter today we went on a hike, and we sort of I took both my girls, and we hike in about 2 miles, and then there's these beautiful rocks beside the river where we get to sit, and I bring some Larabars in. I've got a carrier in case one of them gets tired. So I bring some Larabars, and we sit, and they have a snack, they have a drink of water, and then it's about a mile back to the car. And I was trying to explain to my daughter, who wanted to wipe her hands because she had been, I mean, it's the hike that's more for them than for me until they get tired and I'm carrying 80 pounds a kid, then it's totally a hike for me. But the rest of the time, yeah, it's their pace, and we're stopping and looking at things, and we're, you know, feeling what moss feels like, and we're writing letters in dirt with sticks. And so her hands were filthy. And she said, I need to wash my hands before I have my Larabar. And I said, no, you don't. It's good, clean dirt. And she looked at me like I was crazy. And so I had to sit and explain to her that the dirt on her hands was not going to make her sick the way touching things at a doctor's office would make her sick, or the way touching things, you know, at a indoor gymnastics place would make her sick. And those would be times where I would be far more like, okay, you were just touching all that stuff, let's wash your hands before you eat. I don't think she really got it until the moment that she dropped her Larabar in the dirt. And she looked at me, she picked it up, she looked at me, I dropped it in the dirt. And I said, that's okay. And she looked at me like...
That's where the 5-second rule really does.
She looked at me like, really? And yeah, then I was like, yeah, you go ahead and eat it. And so then, like, the whole eating with dirty hands she didn't really like, but the whole, like, she didn't want to miss out on her treat. Mm-hmm. So then it felt totally okay, even though it was covered in dirt. It was the funniest. I mean, 6-year-olds, right? So the conversations are always a little a little different.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was like this whole big, like, trying to explain that dirt is not as dirty as, you know, touching something that looks clean, that's in an area where there's like a lot of sick people touching it. It was a very interesting conversation to have with a 6-year-old.
Well, it's an interesting conversation to have with adults. So it doesn't really stop at 6. I mean, it is, because we're trying to, this is, I think, the nature of what I do with the Primal Blueprint and what paleo perhaps ought to be doing in general, which is kind of to figure out, you know, where you fit in this modern world, given what you know intuitively and through the science, about how the body is supposed to work. And sometimes it's not black and white, and it's not cut and dry, and it's not right or wrong. It's just, you know, these are all just choices. But sometimes you have to kind of stop and think, okay, you know, how does this choice impact what I want to achieve? And in the case of, you know, your daughter picking up the treat that she wanted to have, understanding that the dirt that was on that Larabar wasn't going to be the kind of a germ situation that was going to, you know, cause an issue for the most part. Because I don't know where.
We were in pretty much, I mean.
Remote.
It was remote. We'd hiked in a couple of miles to get there.
But to me, that's just, that's the fun of what we do in this space right now, is kind of figuring out where the hacks are and where the, you know, I get often accused of trying to romanticize the past and saying, well, if it didn't occur 20,000 years ago, we shouldn't do it. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. I'm trying to figure out ways in which we can bring the best of the 21st century to our lives today, to enjoy them and be healthy and happy and productive and feel fulfilled. And if that means using a little bit of science, like whipping out the Purell, if you have just been to a well baby visit at the doctor and there was every manner of sniffle nose going on right there, you know, it's probably appropriate to take advantage of that. But I don't know where I was going with that, other than to say that this is sort of the fun that we have with this, is where does my worldview fit in to the reality of my life?
Balance.
Yeah.
It's all about balance.
So that's sorry to cut you off, Sarah.
That's okay. But I was done.
Okay. So one of the questions, Mark, that I actually was hoping we could talk about is something that I remember you talking about from PaleoFX last year, and you just mentioned it again, which is you were really encouraging people to focus on what was important in their lives, what was fun for them, what made sense. And at the time, I was just stopping nursing my youngest, my third child, my youngest child. I had recently lost 135 pounds, was completely overwhelmed with finishing our first cookbook, and had a lot of things going on in my life and felt really guilty that I wasn't focusing on exercise and getting fit. And one of the things that I remember you saying is that if you're a mother and it's not a priority for you to go work out and you find it more rewarding and beneficial to you to play with your children, then by all means do that. And I was wondering if you could maybe confirm that I remember that correctly, because it has been a year. But maybe expand on, you know, why you think it's really important, why this, you know, by the science and the biology of our bodies, it's really important for us to kind of focus on the things that feel good and right in a positive way in our lives.
Well, yeah. And I think you did recall that, that correctly. I did say that. And I think initially I said it in the context of this concept of ideal body composition, where people think, well, I'm going to start this whole paleo program, so I'm going to get down to, I'm going to be ripped, and I'm going to show my abs, and I'm going to have, you know, the CrossFit muscles and all the stuff that goes along with that. And I'm quite clear that the first reason you get into this is because for health reasons. And the looking good naked is a side benefit. So if you have a family, if you have people that are depending on you, it's from a primal perspective, the expectations, once again, of the hunter-gatherer genes, it is appropriate for you to take this on with the idea that you want to be a complete human being. And if your top priorities are taking care of your kids and raising your kids, by all means do that. Certainly don't sacrifice your health, because I think that's one of the 10 habits of highly successful hunter-gatherers that we talk about in the in the book, which is to be a little selfish. You have to take care of yourself before you can take care of others. But certainly not to obsess on all of the peripheral aspects of being wickedly fit and able to run a 10K and you know, whip out some amazing sprint times or whatever. It's about finding that part of your life that resonates with you and doing it well and making sure that you derive satisfaction and fulfillment from it. The essence of the Primal Connection and why I wrote this book was because so many people have had such great success on the Primal Blueprint. Yeah, Mark, I lost 50 or 75 or 125 pounds, and it's great, and my blood work came back, and my doctor can't believe that I'm eating more fat, and my risk for heart disease has gone down, you know, and all the things that we're used to hearing from these success stories. But for so many people, there's sort of it's almost like a what's next. It's like, okay, I got that handled. I know I can do that for the rest of my life. But why don't I feel more content? Why don't I feel more fulfilled now that I've achieved this? That's what got me prompted to look into these expectations that our brains have about how we organize our lives. And in terms of the daily rhythm of literally getting enough sleep and getting enough sun exposure and acknowledging that our bodies are on a 24-hour rhythmic cycle. It's acknowledging that our brains do expect us to have very deep, strong emotional connections with a very small number of people, but not to have 5,000 Facebook friends that we somehow feel obligated to let them know, what we had for dessert every day. And in the process of writing this book, I started to realize, holy crap, I'm writing this book for me. I'm that guy. I'm the guy who's got, I've got the diet dialed in, and I've got the exercise thing down to where I do as little as possible and still remain fit. I try to play as much as I can. And that was my big thing from the last couple of years, was understanding that play is not only something intuitively I thought I should be doing, but science now proves that the brain expects us to play, and it's part of our development as humans over 2.5 million years of upright bipedal locomotion. All of these things come together to create a different perspective on the world, where it's not so much about the things and accumulating the things, and it's not so much about ascending to the next platform at work or the gold medal or the fastest time. It's about recognizing what we have, which is right now. This is what we have right now. I'm having a blast talking to you ladies right now. I'm not thinking about the overdue mortgage payment. I'm not thinking about, oh my goodness, I've got an assignment, I've got a blog post I got to get going for the next couple of days. No, right now I'm focusing on being here with you and enjoying this moment, because this moment is all we have. And you know, it's a little, may sound a little Deepak and a little,
Hokey
pokey. Wayne Dyer, Airy Farrier, Eckhart or whatever, but it is the truth. And when you go back and look at the hunter-gatherer experience and you realize that the hunter-gatherer does not have the luxury of wallowing in either despair because he screwed up on building the fire or he didn't catch the beast, you got to move on to the next thing. You got to be present. You got to be in the here and now. You can't be wandering down the path and necessarily daydreaming. You have to sort of literally smell the roses and watch out for the charging beasts. And what I'm trying to do with this book is trying to get people to understand that this is that it's a learning process, but that you can develop these same intuitive skills and apply them to your work, your social setting, your family life, your finances, the same way you do to your diet and exercise program.
I think it's really powerful and important, and I've heard you say it before, but I don't think I can ever hear you say it enough, because I know for me personally, I am a type A personality. Sarah's a type A personality. We both have autoimmune disease, and every single person that we've had on the show that has autoimmune disease is a type A personality. And I'm starting to come to realize that it's likely because of the stress that we're all inflicting upon ourselves, that, we have to keep pushing forward and we have to keep looking ahead and we have to keep doing better and we have to keep trying harder. That mentality has stressed my body, and I've never been healthier than the past few months that I have focused on, like you said, being in the present, focusing on the things that I'm doing at the moment. I had an appointment earlier today that I was supposed to be somewhere at 10 o'clock, and my 2-year-old was having a really hard time separating from me. And he was crying and he was like, "Mommy, do it. Mommy, do it. Mommy, stay. Mommy, don't go." And there were tears in his eyes. And I was like, you know what? This is more important to me right now, right here, staying with my 2-year-old, cuddling him until he feels better and he's able to say goodbye and wave goodbye to me and then leave. I don't always have the luxury of being able to postpone an appointment or doing whatever it is. And it felt really powerful and important for me to kind of take that moment and say, spending time with my child who appears to need me is so much more important than this other thing that I think that I need to be doing that can certainly wait. And I think the more specifically, parents or people who have commitments to other people in their lives, whatever that dependent person might be, we really do need to take that time for ourselves, like you said, and focus. And it not only will it benefit everyone around us, but most importantly, it will benefit us. And the longer you are to be healthy, the longer you are to be alive, because you've de-stressed and you focused and you've relaxed, and those things lead to health ultimately.
Well, absolutely. They lead to health and they lead to happiness, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's a positive feedback loop. And also, your kids will pick up on that. And, it's nothing worse than leaving a screaming kid to race to an appointment to come home to a kid who's upset because you left without cuddling. It's really appropriate to stop every once in a while and say, okay, how do I break this cycle? Does it start with hanging out with the child and cuddling and until the child can wave goodbye with a smile, and then being a little late for the appointment? And depending on what appointment it is, sometimes you go to some appointments, you get there on time, and then it's still 45 minutes until you can see.
That's true.
But yeah, it really. And it's a skill and it's a habit, and it still doesn't always work. there are still the times when the pressure and the stress come up on you. But what I'm suggesting is that the more that you can get into that space and the fewer times that you can feel your blood pressure rise and feel your heartbeat increasing because of the stress, the better off you'll be and the more you'll learn to kind of go with the flow. And, that's like I say, I wrote the book for me because I need this as much as anybody. I am a type A and I don't do meditation well. So I have to figure out, okay, how do I incorporate some of these strategies into my life, which is one of the reasons I decided that play was going to become a big part of what I do. So I try to orchestrate, for instance, my movement patterns, my exercise, if that's a word you want to use, around hikes and paddling and playing games and those sorts of things that my mind can be immersed in the immediacy of the moment and not have to worry about being someplace or to not have to worry about counting reps or doing all the stuff that go with a traditional workout.
That's definitely working for you. I aspire to one day. I aspire to one day be able to get fit playing as well.
It's for me. I mean, I've always been fit. That's a rock I carry around my neck, but because it's got its good and bad points. But I have the luxury of having been fit long enough that it doesn't take much for me in the gym. And I go to the gym twice a week and I do some pretty serious, hardcore stuff, but it's minimal. It's high intensity. I'm in and out. I know what I got to do. And then that's what my goal in training is, what can I do that'll allow me to play better and not get injured?
And Stacy and I come from the other end of the spectrum because, Stacy's lost 135 pounds and I've lost 120 pounds. So we come from, obesity.
I was going to say, we come from ice cream.
We come from ice cream or boxes of Oreo cookies at a time. That was my downfall. And coming from being sort of metabolically broken and trying to get to a place of health from there. And it becomes quite we were talking about priorities because it becomes for us, trying to figure out what our bodies need, and trying to figure out what we can give them. And I think that's something, because we both have autoimmune diseases, we get a lot of questions, both individually through our blogs, but also on this podcast related to people with autoimmune disease. And there's the one aspect of it, which is the sort of extra dietary restrictions that people with autoimmune diseases tend to need to be able to do. But then there's that whole other aspect of, getting enough sleep to regulate hormones and heal the body and managing stress and regulating circadian rhythms. And I felt when I read The Primal Connection, I was like, oh, this is chapter 7 is right here. I don't have to write chapter 7 in my book anymore because I can just say, go read The Primal Connection, because this is all of the points of like everything else your body needs to heal.
Well, yeah, I mean, sleep is, again, we all tend to pay lip service to, I know you got to get enough sleep and sleep is critical and blah, blah, blah. Sleep is so huge. It's like it's one of the most, if not probably the most important aspect of our health and recovery on a daily basis. It is there for us. It's not like some, like evolution or God created this, dark time so that we could just like close our eyes and sack out. No, it is restorative, reparative. It resets a lot of what's going on in us. It is so critical. And this cracks me up. Well, it doesn't crack me up. It actually makes me sad how many people will, sort of take that off the list of priorities and say, well, I can sleep when I'm dead. I mean, that's the classic line that people use. But the reality is, I like at least 9 hours a night. I don't always get it, but I try to get dang close to it.
That's my goal too.
Yeah. And I do not make any excuses about it or any apologies for it. It is so critical, and I think it's one of the reasons that I've been able to reclaim health beyond – because, you know, I've always been fit, but I always haven't always been healthy. And I've had, you know, my issues with GI problems and, you know, irritable bowel syndrome and arthritis and chronic injuries and all the stuff that much of which had to do with the grains in my diet. And that was my that was certainly the big eye-opener for me, was getting rid of grains. But as a type A, you have to get the sleep. And the problem with type A's is they're the very people who say, I don't need that much sleep. I'm hyper all the time. I wake up, you know, early and I'm thinking about what I got to do, and I'm laying in bed. If I go to bed before 11, I'm laying there just thinking about all the other things I have to do. And it's so critical to carve out that part of your day and to get that sleep handled.
So do you have a really good strategy for shutting off your brain? Because I could really use some tips. How do you shut off your brain when you're trying to sleep? Sometimes it just won't go off.
Well, and I used to think of myself as a terrible sleeper. And my wife reminds me and tells all of her friends about how annoying it is, because I am asleep within 15 seconds of hitting the pillow now for the last 2 years. And so I don't know whether that's, again, something that I've learned to do. We certainly have set our room up with blackout curtains and white noise and getting, you know, covering up all of the little LED possibilities. And you know, we've really created a space. And I think that's really important for a lot of people, is to create a sleeping space and then have an agreement that no one watches TV. You know, if one of the partners is, you know, restless and wants to watch a little TV, they got to do it elsewhere. And we've created these kind of rules. I use, you know, F-Lux on my computer to dim the lights if I'm working at night. If I'm watching TV, I wear amber glasses. And I use that to allow myself to continue to get my melatonin dialed in for when I do decide to hit the hay.
I didn't even know those things existed. That's awesome.
Oh, it's spectacular. Yeah, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. Yep, and you can get them for like $8 on Amazon.
I'm going to do that as soon as we're done recording the podcast.
Yep. So little tricks like that, and that's really, again, that's what the book is about. It's like, okay, this doesn't mean that you have to go create a fire pit in your backyard and turn off all the electronic stuff and go out and have a fire circle and bang on drums until you're tired. No, this means taking advantage of the best that the 21st century has to offer. And if you want to watch Breaking Bad and, you know, you can handle that kind of stuff, and then put on your yellow tinted glasses and watch for a little while. And, you know, maybe try to give yourself an hour of decompressed time between a TV show and the time you go to bed, in which case you can read or have a chat or whatever. But those are all the little rituals that and humans are creatures of habit and creatures of ritual, and ritual is an important part of who we are, and it's why the fire circle was such a big part of human history, that in the days before TV and radio and even theater and plays, there was the fire circle and there was gossip, which we opened the show with. So
well, I'm glad that you mentioned ritual, because that's I know what's made a huge difference in my being able to fall asleep. Like, I am the person, Mark, that you said, 15 seconds from when my head hits the pillow, maybe, you know, 19 times out of 20, I'm asleep. And it's because I've created a ritual for myself of, okay, these are the things that I do. And I put Beauty Balm on my face. Have you heard of Beauty Balm before, from Green Pastures?
Yeah.
So it's totally this aroma that has become my, like, sleep scent the minute that I put it on. I'm not kidding.
Our listeners, it does not smell like fermented cod liver oil, even though that is a primary ingredient.
It doesn't smell like a box of roses either. No, let's not lie to people. But it has a distinct aroma. It has lavender in it.
Aroma. It's not a bad aroma. It's not – okay, it's not good, but it's not bad. It's unique.
No, but it's an example of, it doesn't really matter whether it's good or
exactly.
bad. If your olfaction has picked it up as something that it's a very Pavlovian type response, and your scent system and your brain says, okay, it must be time for sleep, because every time she puts this on, we're going to sleep. that becomes part of the ritual. And it's fascinating how that stuff works. And it takes like a habit. It takes, 21 days of doing that kind of with a distinct intention of arriving at that eventual effect. But if you do that, that's the kind of stuff that will assist you in falling asleep with regularity and with certainty.
Cool. I used to be the kind of person who would fall asleep in 5 seconds. And then I started writing a book.
I already said you were type A. Like, I threw you under the bus because I know you've been struggling.
I know. And ever since I started writing the book, because now what happens is that time that used to be my decompression time in the evening is now my writing time. And so I don't, because I'm still trying to prioritize sleep, I don't have decompression time. My husband likes to say, all things serve the book.
Okay.
And so when the book is done, hopefully I'll be able to get things back to normal. But that is a complete aside. There was one sort of last topic that I wanted to talk about, and this was a TED Talk that I watched probably a year and a half ago, probably very soon, either like shortly before I decided to adopt a paleo diet and try it out, or either like early on in my journey. But it was a TED Talk by Dan Buett. I don't know if I'm saying his name right. Buettner. Do you know who he is? He's done a bunch of articles for National Geographic, and he's part of the Blue Zone Project. And he did this TED Talk about summarizing the findings from the Blue Zone Project. It was on longevity. So it was called longevity, how to live to be 100 plus. And he talked about looking at things that were habits and lifestyle factors and diet factors that were in common between the most long-lived contemporary humans. And one of the things that always struck home for me, because some of those things are sort of obvious, like, movement and, they talked about some diet factors that kind of made sense to me. One of the things that always really struck home was the importance of social connection and a ritual associated with that social connection. And I really felt like, that'd be a fun thing to talk about because it's so relevant to so much of what you talk about in The Primal Connection, sort of that idea that being connected to people and having a real emotional but also, physical contact type connection can regulate hormones and help manage stress and create an environment in our bodies that's conducive to longevity. Like, that's just such a cool concept.
It is. And as much as these, and again, back to the sort of the biochemistry, animals in particular are served by these feel-good hormones that reinforce behavior that tends to to promote survival. So eating a meal creates a feel-good hormone. Having sex creates a feel-good hormone that tends to promote, survival. And it turns out that some of these, like hugging, it creates a situation where we create these feel-good hormones. Oxytocin is a good example. That's the cuddling hormone. And somebody just sent me a whole post on a Valentine's Day thing wasn't really appropriate for Valentine's Day because it talked about cuddling and oxytocin in the context of human male female relationships, keeping other men away long enough for the sperm to make it to where it needs to go. But I digress. Anyway, it was an interesting theory. But all of these behaviors that we kind of associate with these feel good hormones, whether they're endorphins that we create from exercise, which we know to be good for us, or it's hugging, laughing is another one. A lot of them can be we can generate those through this sort of intimate connection, not just intimate in the sense of male female partnership or whatever partnership, same sex partnership works as well. But just having friends, and we seem to have lost that ability to have very close connections with a small circle of friends. So one of the things we talk about in the Primal Connection is building your fire circle, going back and rethinking your relationships, getting rid of relationships that you recognize to be toxic or destructive or what we call energy sinks, and acknowledging those people who are important parts of your life and reacquainting yourself with them, bringing them back in. And it's amazing how you, when you go through that list of all of your 5,000 Facebook friends, when you try to decide, you know, who you would like to have, speaking at your funeral, for instance, it becomes a much smaller number. And not that I'm suggesting that anybody's got a funeral imminent, but
we're talking about living to 100. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. And so if you want to live to be 100, it does involve having a close-knit circle of friends. And, you know, the studies will show that married people live longer than – married men, anyway, live longer than unmarried men, and that people in these small, close-knit circles, particularly in the blue zones, tend to live longer rather than the outliers who are in the remote areas and don't have any social contacts. So it's and it all makes sense. I mean, I go back to, okay, what is important in my life? Where do I have fun? And personally, I have much more fun having a dinner party with 6 or 8 people where everybody kind of gathers and they're all on the same wavelength and we're fixing the food and we're sitting down and laughing and having a glass of wine, and rather than a party with 50 or 60 people. You know, it's just all of a sudden the whole vibe is different, and it's these intimate connections that I think are much more powerful for us, once again bringing us to that area where we feel fulfilled and we feel satisfied and we feel happy. And that's really what gets people to the age of 100, is this sense of satisfaction, fulfillment, and contentment. The other thing that one of the through lines through all centenarians, all people that live to be 100, is even though they might have very disparate diets and exercise strategies, they seem to roll with the punches. They seem to let stuff go. They seem to be able to absorb a loss and move on and get to the next level. And that's, I think, partly because of their deep social connections.
Yeah.
I completely agree. Although I would say my one exception to that is I do enjoy having a larger ancestral community. I feel like some of the things that Sarah and I have talked about in previous podcasts is that a lot of the families that struggle within, you know, the questions that we get, the people that we talk to are often struggling because it's difficult for them to find a community of people in which they can feel supported and have knowledge. And I think, you know, that intimate social connection that you're talking about, where we have, you know, a very small group of people that, you know, we trust to take care of our children, or that, you know, we would do favors for, that kind of thing is small. But at the same token, we've kind of expanded our inner circle to be a bit wider for like a second layer of what we're calling like our community. And that community is more of like, I think of as the village, right? It takes a village to raise a kid. In one of the success points that we've seen our children do is kind of influence other children to make good choices, whether they be, you know, at a potluck where there sometimes is 50 people. If those 25 couples bring their children and one child sees another child eating kale and spinach and things that they normally wouldn't eat at their own home, there's like this positive peer pressure for then positive things to happen. And so I'm not sure where I'm going with it, other than
No. I think you're right. I think, and again, I didn't mean to obviate the need to have a larger social circle. I think that the close-knit, what we call the fire circle, anywhere from 5 to 12 friends, and I guess my example of the funeral was probably a little bit maudlin. Maybe I would rephrase it as, these are people for whom you would give up a Saturday to help them move.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Okay. But then, you know, expand it to 50 or 80 other people that you would include in your immediate, you know, again, a close-knit group, which would be a meetup group or something like that, if that's what where you're headed with that. Absolutely. Where I'm going is just this this notion that somehow because I know 300 people that I could invite to my daughter's wedding, that I have to kind of treat them all like they're my close friends. The brain can't handle that amount of close connections. So you can have those friends, but it's probably impossible to maintain, you know, close connections with that with all of them without some kind of disconnect happening there.
Yeah, I think that's key, is that, you know, at these meetup groups or whatever it is that people might be having, it's okay and it's normal and it's biologically advantageous for some people to kind of pair up and have closer relationships with them than other people. And then you hang out with those people separate from when you did your big community gathering. And, you know, some of the bloggers that we're friends with, we joke about kind of building out a commune where we, you know, have our chickens and we plant our root veggies, and you know, wouldn't that be fantasy land, right? Like, we can all just kind of start anew with great soil and be barefoot and have a actual fire circle.
I have those same discussions with friends.
Yeah, it's, you know, if it weren't so crazy, then it would be awesome. Yeah. You know, like, yeah. So I completely get and appreciate exactly what you're saying. I just want to, until we can all kind of build our commune and go out and be among our own people, so to speak, I think it is important to, you know, surround yourself with, you know, we get a lot of questions like
United States of paleo.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Ancestral village, you know. But even with things that aren't related to kind of food, you know, breastfeeding, for example, like if a woman is only surrounded by women who are bottle feeding their babies, they're a lot more likely to end up on that path than if they find a group of people, whether that be, you know, through Little HA League or through wherever, to like, you surround themselves with that positive support. And I think it's the exact same with this ancestral lifestyle. You know, you expand your horizons and you learn the great things about, you know, eating blueberries with bird poop on it as being okay, because yeah, you're part of this larger community and you grow and you expand, and that makes you a better person in general, you know, and yep, it helps you help other people. So,
agreed.
Well, that's great. Mark, I don't know if Sarah has anything else she wants to ask you, but I can't thank you enough for being on our show and for putting all the material out there that you have. We didn't really give a proper intro to your book, The Primal Connection, but I think we've kind of explained what it is. Do you want to give kind of an elevator speech, so in just in case people haven't wrapped their mind around it at this point, and anything else that you have going on that you want to share with people?
Sure. I mean, the Primal Connection is just a way for people to achieve a level of satisfaction and fulfillment and contentness that they might be seeking, despite the fact that they think they have their diet and exercise dialed in. It explores the way the brain expects certain inputs, and if you don't give the brain those inputs, you can create conflict, which may manifest itself in disease, but at the very least can manifest itself in just a sense of unhappiness. So it's an interesting book, if I do say so myself. There are a lot of great hacks in here, and as I say, I wrote it for myself because I know I'm the one who needs this stuff. And it's at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and all of the normal booksellers. And then, of course, Mark's Daily Apple, the blog, where we post something new and exciting and hopefully entertaining every day for the last 6.5 years.
That's crazy, by the way.
You have no idea.
I do know how crazy that is. That's why I'm not doing it. Yeah. No, well, the content is great, and, you know, we subscribe to your newsletter, and I would suggest that people do that, because it's great to not kind of miss a beat that way. So, and the content that you're putting out isn't just content for the sake of putting it out. It's often very useful and engaging, and like I said, helps learn and grow, because I'm being part of your community by subscribing to this newsletter. So,
and I appreciate that.
Sarah, got anything?
No, I just want to echo Stacy's appreciation and say thank you so much for joining us. This was really fun.
My pleasure. I had a blast.
And good luck getting yourself some awful. We don't want you to be too jealous.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, all great. Right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I feel like I need a mat then.
You've got a family. I mean,
I do. I need a savior though.